Welcome to Skeptica, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, well, we have an episode about Skeptico. Now, I don't do many shows about the show. In fact, I don't think I've ever done one, but I know from my own experience of visiting other podcasts, you sometimes need an entry point into what the show is all about, or it winds up sounding a lot like Inside Baseball, kind of, that is, techie talk with a lot of acronyms and abstract references to material that's been covered in previous shows that you never quite get. Like I said, I've been there enough times to realize that that can be, on one hand, kind of exhilarating to dip into a different world, but also kind of frustrating to not really know what people are talking about. So I don't know why I think now at episode 229 is the right time to do it, but I just kind of felt like it was, and I wanted to lay out for you, if I could, the five things you need to know about Skeptico. And I think this would apply to you if you're a new listener, or you may even find it somewhat interesting if you've been with the Skeptico show for a while. So let's get right to it. The first thing you should know about Skeptico is that I approach Skeptico as my personal journey towards answering the biggest questions about life. Who are we? Why are we here? And most importantly, how should I live my life based on those questions? So I try and wrap Skeptico in a nice iTunes interview WordPress format that hopefully you find accessible and enjoyable and entertaining. But at the end of the day, that dressing up is mainly so that I can keep talking to the people I want to talk to, which of course includes you. And that's also why you'll never see any advertisements on Skeptico. You'll never hear me ask for any donations or anything like that. The show is really about my personal journey. I'm not trying to get anywhere with it. I'm not trying to advance any cause, run for office, create a name for myself, or anything else. I just want to do my best to answer these questions and along the way share my journey with everyone else. Point number two, the second thing you should know about Skeptico is that the show is about following the data wherever it leads. Or at least it started out that way, but let me not digress into that for a minute. The point I wanted to make here is that when I started out, I had this idea that if I wanted to find out about this stuff, even this really big stuff, like questions about who am I, that I could just go out and find the data. I could go talk to the very best experts. I could go then talk to critics of those experts and then critics of those critics. I could follow the data wherever it led and I would get to some sort of answer. And to a certain extent, that works. But now back to my little digression, because I have to tell you that in the process of doing that, following the data wherever it leads, I came to the realization that it's not just about the data. It's about all the other stuff. And this has turned out to be a really important part of my little Skeptico journey here because it opened me up to two things. One, that people can have worldview differences that dramatically alter their ability to objectively look at data. And number two, it pushed me beyond that to then ask the question of whether or not that process of worldview formation is always under our control or whether there are other influencers that are trying to manipulate our worldview. It's a topic that I've returned to several times because it does seem to keep popping up. So this idea that it's not just about the data, it's about all the other stuff, has been a reoccurring theme on Skeptico, but I want to play for you a clip from an episode of Skeptico that I think for me was really the turning point in this understanding. And it had to do with this series of interviews that I did with science writer and skeptic Ben Radford about psychic detectives. So I have an extended clip here from episode 151 of Skeptico that I think sums up what I'm talking about. Here goes. So here's the situation. We interviewed psychic Nancy Weber about the work she did associated with a murder in New Jersey. And you can go back and listen to all these interviews. I'll provide links in the show notes here, and you can really dig into this. It's a fascinating case, I think. But for the purposes of this show, I'm going to keep it really brief. And here's the interview that Ben did with Nancy concerning the information that she provided to the police.
Okay. And what specifically, in a nutshell, did you tell, specific information did you give Warren Hughes about Hoffman's killer?
Sure. I saw a fairly tall, maybe 5'10", 5'11", slim-built man, aquiline kind of shaped face. And I saw a lot of dark hair on his head. And then I saw the hair being taken off, almost like a wig, and it would be a buzz cut with a very high widow's peak. I kept seeing that. And then I got the name James as I was riding. And then I got that he knew the Hollow in Morristown, which is a particular area in Morristown. As we were riding around, I also smelled gasoline, smelled an auto shop or a gasoline station, and I knew he was associated, and then I got the word brother. So to me, his brother had either owned, worked at a station, and the car that James would be driving would have that. Then I got Polish, and I connected that as Polish descent. That took me to Florida for some reason, where I felt in prison. And I felt him being locked away in prison for murder. And I remember saying to them, oh, my God, he was in Florida in jail for murder. Not one. And they let him out. And, you know, as I'm saying it, I'm getting it. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but I didn't know it as and then said it. I'd be just letting the words spill out, and I'd go, they released him, those idiots.
Okay, now, first, let me tell you, big picture, the police consistently, still to this day, say that Nancy provided valuable information and that her information was amazingly accurate. They said that to me. They said that to the original TV show they did. They said that to Ben Radford. But in Ben Radford's debunking exercise, what he attempted to do was focus on some inconsistencies, what he thought were inconsistencies. So I'm going to play you again one little clip out of there that he focused in on, okay? And it has to do with her saying that the murderer had gone to Florida and was incarcerated down there and then was released. Let me play that for you again right now.
And I remember saying to them, oh my God, he was in Florida in jail for murder.
Okay, so Ben couldn't refute the fact that Nancy's information was amazing and the police thought it was amazing and thought it was accurate, and after the fact it all matched up and all that. So what he focused on was this little point, and he said in our interview, in the interview with me, he said, hey, you know what? Those cops told me that she didn't say that he came from Florida, just that he came from the South. And I said, well, Ben, that's not correct. I have it right here. I have the transcript of the interview that I did with Captain Moore. And he was insistent. And finally, I said, Ben, let's get him on the phone. And we called him and got him on the phone. And here's what Captain Moore said.
Hello, this is Jim.
Hi, Captain Moore. This is Alex Sakaris again from Skeptico. And I have Ben Radford from the Skeptical Inquirer on the line.
Hey there. How you doing?
So as I was explaining, Ben and I had an interesting chat with Nancy this morning. Then we got off the phone and we started arguing like we do.
Because we do that.
But, you know, Ben has some potential inconsistencies he sees between the account that you gave to me and the account that you gave to him. We thought the easiest way to clear that up was to get you on the phone for just a few minutes, and I'm going to let Ben take over. Go ahead, Ben.
Nancy claimed that she specified that Hoffman's killer had come from Florida, but both you and Hughes say that you recall that it wasn't necessarily Florida, it was just in the South. Do you remember which one it was?
No. I said Florida. She told me that he lived in the Morristown area, went to Florida. While he was in Florida, he killed someone, went to jail. When he was in jail, he killed an inmate. That's what I told you.
And that's what you told me on my interview, and I have a transcript of that as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to know what Nancy said to me before Kadadage was arrested, she told me that whoever committed this crime, went to Florida and was living in Florida, killed someone, went to prison in Florida, and then killed an inmate while he was in Florida. For some reason, unknown, he got out. And after he got out of prison, he came back to the Morristown area.
Okay.
That's what she told me when I first met her, and she was going through what she could feel or sense.
I love that. You can kind of hear the strain in Ben's voice as this veteran homicide detective gets in his face and says, no, that's what I told you. Now get it right. So then Ben and I went a little bit further, and he said, okay, well, yeah, what about the other guy, Lieutenant Hughes? He told me that Nancy said that the killer came from the South, not from Florida. As if that would make much of a difference, that all this amazing information, and that's the point he wants to raise, is whether she said specifically Florida or the South. But be it as it will, that's the discussion we got into. And again, I said, no, you're wrong. He said Florida. And he was insistent. I said, let's get him on the phone. So we had a conference call. We got Lieutenant Hughes on the phone. Here's how that interview went.
Lieutenant Hughes.
Hey, Lieutenant Hughes. It's Alex Sakaris again from Skeptico.
Yes.
Thanks again. I'm not going to take too much time. Let's turn it over to Ben. Ben is concerned about some potential inconsistencies he sees between the interview you gave with me and the interview you gave with him. So let's let him kind of take it over.
Okay. Actually, I'm not that inconsistency. I'm trying to reconcile what Nancy said. This is all regarding the information that she gave in 82 before Kadatich was arrested. For example, she says that she said specifically that that the Hoffman's killer had come up from Florida. But from what you told me, and I think also other places, that you said that you didn't remember her saying specifically Florida, just in the South. Is that right?
No. I might have said that, but no. She knew that the guy had killed before and that he had killed in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, she knew that he had killed before and that he had killed in Florida.
Okay.
That he had done prison time in Florida.
Okay, because what you told me was that you said that he'd done time in the South. You said, I don't recall her specifically saying that he'd done time in Florida, just that he'd done time in the South.
No, I do remember Florida. Maybe I was being generic or whatever the case
okay.
might be, but I do know that she said Florida.
Okay, so this is case closed. No reasonable person at this point, no reasonable journalist with any kind of integrity would at this point still hold on to this issue. Well, you know what that brings us to. Ben's broadcast a couple months later on Michael Shermer's Skeptical podcast. Here's what Ben had to say.
Nancy Weber said that she specified that a Hoffman's killer had served prison time in Florida. He said, quote, he came up from Florida where he'd been in prison for murder. Well, now this is interesting because that's not the same story that you hear when you interview the police officers. For example, Sergeant Hughes told me that Weber only stated the killer, quote, had served time in the South. And it's important to remember that the way that psychic detectives appear to be accurate and appear to have amazing information is by giving information that seems very specific at the time, but is in fact very general. For example, psychic detectives will say, well, the body will be found near water. So that's a good example of how something that can seem very specific is in fact very general. And that's exactly the technique that Nancy Weber used in this case.
So I don't know, what do you want to call that? Misrepresentation? Misremembering? Lie? I don't know what kind of words you want to throw at it, but it's stunning. It's stunning, but it would be more stunning if it hasn't happened over and over and over again on this show, and we have countless examples, and all you have to do is go through the archives and listen to Richard Wiseman, and listen to Ray Hyman, and listen even to Stephen Novella, listen to James Randi. It's a consistent pattern. We can't even call Ben out for being especially over the top in terms of misreporting this stuff. It has to do with the bias, the worldview. It clouds their vision, and they're just like the fanatical conservative religious folks that they so despise that can't get past the obvious problems in their logic. It's the same situation repeated over and over again. Okay, so that ends that clip. And here's a case where I started out with the idea of following the data wherever it leads and was smacked in the face by the realization that it's not about the data. It's about all this other stuff that causes people to have entrenched worldviews, entrenched belief systems, and then fight and resist any change or any challenge to those. So I guess that rolls right into point three of what you should know about Skeptico. And that is that what I'm really about is getting past these stuck-on-stupid debates, as I call them. And that, I've found, turns out to be pretty hard to do because we are surrounded by and enmeshed in a lot of stuck-on-stupid debates. One example of this that we've spent a good deal of time talking about on this show, because in various forms it seemed to keep popping up again and again, is the do Christians, or substitute any religion you like in there, know the true path to God, or are atheists right? So there's a good stuck-on-stupid debate for you, and I say that because, as far as I can tell, both sides have some pretty darn stupid arguments. So I'd like to take a minute and break down that debate a little bit by playing a couple of clips from past Skeptico shows so you can see why I think both sides are stuck-on-stupid. So as an example of how the Christian argument gets derailed in this way, I have an example from episode 199 of Skeptico, when filmmaker Chris White joined me to talk about his popular and very impressive documentary, Ancient Aliens Debunked. So Chris, who is otherwise a very smart and capable guy, you watch his documentary, it's extremely well researched, well put together, well thought out. This is not a dumb guy. And during the interview, we talked almost entirely about his debunking of the Ancient Aliens television show. But we did talk about this one hot topic that jumps up when you talk to Chris, and that has to do with some of his beliefs in terms of Christianity and a literal interpretation of the Bible. Here's a clip from that show. So, Chris, your Christian beliefs have also become a hot topic of conversation as it relates to the film. Again, to emphasize to people, this is not a Christian-oriented film. It isn't making a case. It isn't evangelical in nature. But at one point, you do come to talking about the flood mythology, and you make reference to the Noah's Ark, and is that being confirmed by nautical engineers? And then if anyone, you're a pretty open guy out there, you're very public, if anyone just pursues that at all, they find that you're a pretty darn conservative Christian. And I guess you're supportive of the idea that the Noah's Ark story has a realness to it, and that and process that. I mean, you got to understand, right? I mean, if people are astounded when they learn that you think a 500-year-old man built this big boat, loaded it up with all these animals from around the world, and cruised the oceans for a year, it's hard for a lot of people to swallow that.
Well, I mean, certainly we could talk about Noah's Ark, and that's certainly something that's come up a lot. You know, the thing is, I think that there's a lot of general sort of presuppositions about this, and comes from like Sunday school version of Noah's Ark and things like that. But the text is actually quite technical about Noah's Ark, and it explains a lot of these things that and I think that the issue is very defendable. There's been a good paper, it's often referenced, called the feasibility study for a lot of things like that, like the different animals, how could you get them on the ark, and so on and so forth. And I would actually take a bit different view, in that I don't think you got to work dinosaurs into the equation, like I think is so often an unfortunate thing that has been a part of this defense. But the point is that the idea is feasible. One of the many things a BBC article thing did recently is like, you can't build a boat that big, a wooden boat that big, because it would just crush under its weight. And, you know, there's been really good work done on that to essentially say, first of all, there isn't anybody saying that metal wasn't a part of this. I mean, you know, even the Bible mentions that metalworking was before this and so on. Besides, you don't even, I could go into the details, but I'm not sure if that's the direction we want to go here. But all these different things about the ark itself, I think, have very rational explanations. And if one takes the time to look into those things, I think that you'll at least come to the conclusion that, hey, there is a rational defense of this.
Well, I don't know about that last part in terms of rational explanations or not, and I didn't pursue it too far with Chris because it wasn't the main point of the show, but also because these did Noah use nails in the ark debate are the kind of debates I don't want to have. I mean, I guess there are some real archaeological questions there, and I want to be open to hearing some of that stuff, but it's pretty much in the shallow end of the pool when it comes to these who am I questions. But I digress again, because to really understand why I think this is a stuck-on-stupid debate, we have to look at the other side of the table who's sitting across from us, and that is the atheist, who's built his house on a very sandy foundation, and that is the belief that consciousness, that is the sum total of your human experience, consciousness is an illusion created by a biological robot. You, of course, being that biological robot. Now, this statement, which I've often repeated on Skeptico, but let me break it down for you because it's really a mashup of two of the most popular atheist thinkers of our time. That is philosopher Dr. Daniel Dennett, who famously said, consciousness is an illusion, and Dr. Richard Dawkins, who of course said that humans are biological robots. Now, we've explored at great length on Skeptico how atheists often like to run from these philosophical underpinnings that prop up atheism, just like Christians like to run from the literal Noah's Ark thing. But I would suggest to you this ambivalence, this not knowing whether I should embrace the core beliefs of my group, in this case, embrace consciousness is an illusion created by biological robots, or whether I should run from it, is really at the core of these stuck-on-stupid debates. Now, since I played for you a clip from conservative Christian Chris White, let me also play for you a clip from my recent interview with popular atheist author and Christian debunker John Loftus, because I think it demonstrates the cognitive dissonance that we go through when we're drawn into these kind of debates. Here, John and I are talking about what it means to fully embrace being a biological robot.
Well, we still have these arguments, and they still change minds.
There are no minds. We are biological robots. I mean, we can't change brains. They're robotic. They just act according to their preconceived. This is ludicrous. Look, I understand where you're coming from. You're focusing on Christianity and debunking Christianity, and there's a lot to be done there. But I think you've kind of made my case to a certain extent. It logically falls apart. And moreover, like I always tell people is, your philosophy isn't as complicated as it seems. It's how you live your life, And point to me the person who lives their life like love isn't real, like connection with people isn't real.
Sure.
It's silliness, it's absurdity in the same way that some of this other stuff in terms of biblical inerrancy gets into the absurd really quickly when you follow it.
I'll make an argument that if that's the case, if that's the case, there's no other way around living our lives like we do and making the arguments that we do.
You can cut that short and just say there's no reason to really live your life. The famous philosopher Albert Camus said this, there's only one philosophical question, suicide. If you really believe that life is that meaningless, there's no need to continue the meaninglessness. There's no need for future generations or past generations or evolution. It's all meaningless. There's no reason to go on. That's the logical extension here. And of course it's absurd, but it's the absurdity of the atheist position, I should say. All I can say is that when we falsify the idea that you are this biological robot, and we accept that that's absurd. And once we get past the idea that consciousness ends at death, which is, again, like you said before, only I don't think you want to accept it, but that's where the evidence points. It just points that way. I don't know what that means, John. When I cross that chasm and I say, okay, that's the evidence and I have to deal with it, a lot of things start falling differently in terms of how I orient myself to the world, how I orient myself to other people, how I orient myself to morals, purpose, meaning in life. So that is what I'm exploring
but I'm exploring it from the other side of the chasm.
Other side of the chasm.
Being consciousness survives death. You are not a biological robot.
Well, you know, you. Okay. All right. Fine. I mean, I disagree. I've said why. So.
That's always, of course, you disagree. You stand up and say, I am a biological robot. I am going to stand by that.
Well, there's no evidence for invisible beings or entities.
Hey, but you, as you live your life like a biological robot.
Everybody does. That's all there is.
Now, of course, these examples that I've given you aren't the only kind of stuck-on-stupid debates out there. These kind of debates crop up all the time on Skeptico. One example that didn't make it into the podcast, but is something that we talked about on the Skeptico forum, comes from a really interesting panel discussion titled Reversing Death, The Miracle of Modern Medicine. And it featured Steve Paulson, who's a journalist with NPR and has been on this show before and is very interested in these topics. And it also featured three very prominent, highly regarded experts on resuscitation. One is Sam Parnia, who you may know. He's been on the show. He's also an expert in near-death experience research. But first and foremost, he's one of the foremost experts in resuscitation. The panel also included Lance Becker and Stefan Mayer, two folks I didn't know so much about. But all these people are top-notch physicians and research experts with degrees and credentials that are extremely, extremely impressive. So during this panel discussion, they talked about a number of topics associated with resuscitation, brain death, last will stuff, but you kind of felt like sooner or later they were going to move on to near-death experience because it's such a hot topic. And eventually they did. And near the end of their discussion on near-death experience, there was a Did Noah's Ark Have Nails moment. It comes near the end of the clip. Let me play it for you and see if you can catch it.
I'm surprised that none of you has talked about what is classically called a near-death experience. You know, people who have come back and who report astonishing things that they experienced.
As you've pointed out, I mean, this is an area that I'm very interested in, and this is actually what got me into cardiac arrest work, was when I was a student and I had a patient who I got to know very well who essentially died in front of me. They tried to save him and they couldn't, and I was left asking this question as to what's happening to this person as he's going through this, as he's flatlined, as they're all sort of, you know, standing away and saying that's the end. Is he able to hear us? Is he able to see us? What happened to his consciousness? And just to sort of take a slight bit of revenge on you for not inviting me for that session, I'm just
you can so come back. You can be in the audience.
One of the
this,
best,
by the way, two sessions for in December. We're going to be talking about near death experience. Right.
I will come back. But one of the best things, one of the best things I ever heard someone say was
dead.
What you said once. So I was listening to one of your podcasts. I think it was actually a session that was done here a year or two ago, and you said that when you go home at night, you have this fascination with consciousness, and you pick up books while your wife is reading, like, the latest novel on whatever. You pick up a book on consciousness, and it's this big, and you find it fascinating, and you read it to the end. And that's
one of those was your books, by the way.
Oh, really good.
Yeah.
So I'm the same. I'm a physician, but I'm also fascinated with consciousness, which is, what is it that makes us into who we are? And one of the big questions we have right now in science and for this century, really, is how do brain processes possibly lead to this thinking, conscious being that makes us into who we are? And the general theory out there, of course, it's not been proven, is that somehow brain cell processes somehow generate the mind, generate thoughts, generate who we are. But, of course, there's no theory or even a plausible biological mechanism to account for how cells could even generate a single thought. So now take that and bring it to the subject of what happens when we die. Well, after, you know, CPR was first discovered, about 15 years after that, a book was published which chronicled the experiences that people have had when they've been close to death or when their hearts had stopped. And essentially, these people all described feeling peaceful. They had a universal experience of feeling immense peace, seeing a bright, warm, welcoming light that draws them towards it, seeing a tunnel, seeing deceased relatives, sometimes welcoming them, sometimes describing seeing a being that was full of love and compassion that would take them through essentially an educational experience where they relived everything that they had done and they had said. And they judged themselves with this being's help. And often they describe going to a beautiful place. And at some point, they realized they had to come back. And a small proportion of them also describe watching doctors and nurses working on them. And that's the classical near-death experience. Now, the explanations that were put forward in the 70s and 80s were that this is probably just simply lack of oxygen, a change in carbon dioxide level, and I think those are now antiquated with what we understand. So all we can say essentially is that, and the reason someone like me is interested in this is, in order for us to save a person and bring them back, we have to understand what happens to the brain, to the cells, after a person has technically died. But we can never forget there's a person there. So what does happen to their consciousness? And the evidence we have so far, and it's an emerging field, is that when a person has technically died, their brain flatlines, and no human experience should be happening at that time whatsoever. Paradoxically, 10 to 20% of people do come back and they report these incredible experiences.
How do we know that they're not recalling these experiences as they're coming back to consciousness, as they're coming out of the coma?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's been part of what I've been trying to study, and I will be releasing the results of our study in a month or so at a conference that at the American Heart Association conference. But there are cases which don't support that, including what we found in our research, where essentially you can time the person's experience. You can see they will tell you exactly what was happening to them 15 or 20 minutes into their cardiac arrest rather than just the beginning or just the end where the brain function was coming back online again. So,
wait, I just want to follow up on this. You're saying they're reporting what that happened 15 or 20 minutes ago. They're reporting conversations that were heard? Or
they describe, what? So if you, a proportion of people will describe in incredible detail conversations, events that were happening, clothing, everything that happened, except that, as far as we can tell, their brain at that time should be flatlined, and at best it's very, very disorganized. Yet, they come back, it's not just a subjective experience of I saw a tunnel, I saw a light. They will say that, well, Dr. Mayer came in here, and he was wearing a navy suit with a tie that was sort of brown and it had stripes on it, and he said, my God, this guy doesn't look very good. Let's call his wife. And then my wife was crying. And in all this time, someone's doing this, yeah, and someone's doing that. You know.
By the way, so no resuscitation is ever going to be caught dead wearing a tie, just so you know. messed up.
Are you now talking about what are classically called out-of-body experiences? I mean, the entity hovering at the top of the ceiling, looking down at the operating table?
You should have invited me, I told you, Steve. So I hate that term, near-death experience, and out-of-body experiences. I'll tell you why. Because there are labels that have been put forward since the 70s, which basically polarizes people into the religious people and the non-religious scientific people. And the fact is, we're dealing with a human experience. In the same way that 50 years ago, if you said that we could study love through science, they think it's non-scientific. But actually, we can. So the people that we study are not near death. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't like to call their experiences out-of-body experiences. They are people who have gone through death, as far as we understand it technically. And they have a unique experience. And part of that is having a sensation of seeing themselves and watching and hearing things. So they have consciousness present when consciousness should not be present, as far as our science tells us today.
The obvious conclusion that what we draw from this is that there's some aspect of the mind, of consciousness, that is not associated with a corresponding brain state.
Well, like I said, I mean, this is very much a subject that's early and just being studied. There haven't been many studies, but we have to be open to it. It's possible, like I said, there is enough anecdotal evidence and there are enough cases that have occurred that suggests that consciousness may continue when brain function has ceased. And to answer a point that Stefan raised, which I think is very important, yes, when you interview them afterwards, most of them don't recall anything. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is simply because their brain was severely traumatized, they were given lots of sedative drugs, and all of those together wipe out their memory circuits. It's similar to the fact that we all have a dream, but if you were to ask us the following day, we don't recall the dream. We didn't have it. The evidence that I've seen from patients that we've studied is that actually many more of them probably have the experience, but with time they forget it. So if you don't interview them at the appropriate time, they won't recall it in the same way that people forget their dreams. So it's a completely new area that's really come about. It's the flip side of the coin. One side is to save the brain. The other side is also we're beginning to study what happens to consciousness.
Lance, I want to bring you in here. What do you make of these near-death experiences?
I think that Sam really sort of has this right, which is I think we have to be open to it, and I think that we have to try to understand it, because there's certainly data that is coming to us that right now we just can't really adequately explain, is what I think most of us think. Like, I just don't have a really good explanation for it. I think we have to be just dead honest with ourselves and say we don't have a good explanation for this. And because it's so intrinsically surrounding this very important event, I think we're at a point where we need to learn more about it and need to sort of delve into it. And so,
but that's interesting. I mean, what you are saying though is you're not willing to say, oh, this is clearly just the result of some biochemical hallucination. You are open to the possibility something more might be going on.
I am open to anything that we can sort of begin to understand about it, and it might include things about firing of neural receptors, and it may have to do with other things that are really outside of what we understand right now. So whether you want to call it quantum sort of interactions on some level, you know, like, I've never seen an electron. But that doesn't prevent me from sort of believing that it might exist. I think in a similar way, we need to be open to sort of trying to understand what is this. And I'm a very practical sort of clinician fundamentally. It's like, well, so what are the important things that I need to know to help a patient manage it, help a family management, to bring to sense peace to people about it? I think that we have a responsibility to sort of learn more about that.
Stefan, from what you were saying earlier, I got the sense that maybe you are the resident skeptic on the panel here, but is that true? What do you think?
I'm thinking about how to put all this together, and I'm going to make a guess about what Sam's been talking about. I think, for instance, we've got people in our ICU, and they can become pulseless, and we run EEG on them all. Right, so we've got. So I can already tell you that 1 minute, 60 seconds after, right, when we're getting ready to start the chest compressions, you've still got some brain waves, right? And we know that there's a point in time, as the blood pressure remains very low, that the EEG quickly kind of slows down, right? And we would think conventionally, well, then, okay, I guess all the electrical activity of the brain has stopped. It's all about electricity with our brain. But what we've started to learn is in some of our coma patients, we now put little wires down into the brain that can measure electrical activity deep in the brain. These are probes. They're called EEG depth electrodes that we send down along with pressure monitors and oxygen monitors and measures of physiology. Well, we've already seen cases where with the conventional EEG on the surface, it's flat. But then when you have the little depth EEG, guess what? Brain's still working. It's just turned off the cortical mantle, but the subcortical structures are still working. So there may be a pretty simple or easy to understand, non-mystical, physiologic explanation for why people can grab and retain memories and remember that I'm a bad dresser during a 20-minute CPR if they get resuscitated. There actually may be a physiologic basis for that. And I think as physicians and scientists, that's what we're going to look first. And I guess wherever our levels of understanding end, we're getting more and more understanding, but we're never going to understand it all. And then that's beyond that boundary. That's where we got to kind of fill in the blanks, and we're dealing with something that's still unknowable.
First off, let me say that Dr. Stefan Mayer, who you just heard talking, is obviously a smart guy, a leader in the field of resuscitation. He's forgotten more about medicine and science than I ever knew. But when it comes to near-death experience science, he's using some did Noah's Ark have nails logic. He's suggesting that there's some deep brain activity that's undetectable by EEG that could explain the complex, deep,
hyper-lucid experiences that people are having where they're seeing things outside of their body in other rooms while their eyes are closed and covered. Now, to suggest that is to say that everything we know about how the brain works is wrong. Because, hey, we don't have a model for the brain that explains how you can see with your eyes closed. We don't have a model for the brain about how you can hear conversations in a hallway three floors down while you're on a gurney being resuscitated. Heck, we don't even have a model for the brain for how you can be having these experiences and not have an EEG going off like crazy. So for Dr. Mayer to suggest that, oh, don't worry, boys, we'll figure all this out eventually, and not sound some sort of alarm based on the data that he has and accepts, because he does accept that near-death experiences are happening, and that they are happening during a time when the EEG is flat. So for him not to announce that as some kind of enormous mystery that requires our immediate and serious attention, and instead to shift the focus on these deep brain probes, is a did Noah's Ark have nails moment. It's shifting the focus away from a topic that you don't feel really comfortable addressing so that you can kind of grind on something that's really pretty meaningless. In this case, it's a little more subtle, it's a little more refined, but basically it's the same thing. And that leads me into point four of things you should know about Skeptico. And that is that if Skeptico is about moving past these stuck on stupid debates, these did Noah's Ark have nails kind of debates, then what kind of dialogues am I looking to have? Well, one of the things that really drives me, motivates me, excites me, is all the interesting questions that lie beyond these debates. And there are so many of them, and I want to get to them. I'm less interested in whether or not Sam Parnia's new AWARE study will win over some of the atheist skeptics who are still on the fence about the reality of near-death experience. What I'm interested in is comparing near-death experiences with other experiences with extended human consciousness, whether they be a DMT-induced hallucination or a Kundalini experience or a UFO encounter. That's the kind of question that lies beyond the whole consciousness is an illusion of a biological robot, stupid stuff. Now, to get to that next level kind of discussion, I'm going to have to circle back from time to time to revisit my assumptions, and I have to be aware and honest about the fact that consciousness is an illusion of a biological robot thing I'm talking about happens to be the dominant scientific paradigm, so we can't pretend it doesn't cast a huge shadow on any serious scientific conversation we might have. I don't want to pretend that's not true. And similarly, I want to be real about our culture's Judeo-Christian roots. And now that can cast a shadow on all conversations we might have about the spiritual implications we might discover when we go beyond this extended human consciousness. So I'm going to need to circle back and re-examine some of our spiritual traditions and religious traditions from time to time as well. And I'm sure I'll do that in future shows. And then finally on this point, I think I also have to be realistic and accept that this path that I'm on is not going to be wildly popular. And most folks have a worldview belief system that's dominated either by this scientific materialistic neo-Darwinism atheism kind of thinking or this true believer religious status quo kind of track. And since I've come to believe and understand that both are based on some pretty crippling assumptions, I gotta accept that, at best, people are gonna probably be confused about where I stand, or, and this seems to happen a lot, as you know, darn right hostile to me trampling all over their sacred, cherished beliefs about science and or spirituality. And that brings me to the fifth and final point that you should know about the Skeptico show. And that is that the reason I do Skeptico is so that I can connect with you, so that I can create this community with other people who share my beliefs and interests and desire to kind of figure out these problems. You know, a long time ago,
the U.S. presidential first lady, Hillary Clinton, was derided for saying that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, I guess I've always felt intuitively the same thing about my path. It's going to take a village for me to figure out who I really am. And that's why at various times in the Skeptico show, I've tried to engage with other people to either come on and guest host with me or participate in other ways in the show or get involved with various projects. I like that. I think that community building is a part of not just the Skeptico show, but part of my path and what I want to do, because I do think it takes a village. And I'm really grateful to the folks who listen to the show for being part of that village of mine. Whether you like the show or sometimes like the show or usually almost always don't like the show, it still, in some way that I don't fully understand, contributes to moving this whole enterprise forward. So I'm not exactly sure how all this came out, and I'm not sure if it gives you a better understanding of what this show is about, but I hope it does, and I hope this show becomes something that I can point people to in the future and say, if you're just joining this show or if you've just listened to a couple episodes and you're intrigued, look here at episode 229 and you'll get an idea of where I'm coming from and why we do the things we do here. So with that, I'd like to invite you to join this village, join this community, and connect with me on any of the points raised in this episode. Of course, the place to do that is at the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can leave me a comment about the show or hopefully jump over to the new improved Skeptico forum, and I'm going to have a big link there where you can come over and join us in a conversation over there. I think you'll like what you'll see in the new forum, and if you don't like what you see, become a part of making it what you want it to be. That's what it's about. Would love to get your input and your ideas for future direction. We want to create a place that is open to a variety of viewpoints, but first and foremost is getting past these stuck-on-stupid debates and getting towards the real, meaty, important topics that we want to talk about. So join us over there and become a part of making that happen. While you're there at the Skeptical website, of course, you can check out all of our over 200 previous shows, subscribe to the show, or join our email list to get regular updates on when the show comes out. I have a number of interesting shows coming up, including a couple more on this UFO extended consciousness connection. We have a lot more to talk about there. I haven't been able to be on the forum quite as much as I'd like because I have a number of other things going on, but hopefully that'll change in the upcoming weeks. I do appreciate you listening and joining me for all of this. Until next time, take care and bye for now.